my fists, nails biting into my palms as I force myself to stay calm. My mind is already spinning through the worst-case scenarios. The police finding the bodies of my sister and son, Scothen murdering them before taking his own life. No, no. I clamp down on the thought before it unravels me. I squeeze my eyes closed to get a grip, and when I open them, Betts is watching me, that smirk still curling his mouth like he's actually enjoying my pain, like he can smell the fear and is loving it. This is all his fault. All of it. Hatred burns through my chest, sharp and searing, but I swallow it down. I can't afford rage right now. I can't afford anything except to keep myself in check. I force my expression into something blank, something that won't give me away. I don't know where my family are. I have nothing to bargain with, but I'll be damned if I let him see my pain. The lift pings, the doors sliding open at the 70th floor. My heart thunders against my ribs as I step into the hushed, luxurious hallway. The smell of polished wood clings to the air, usually a pleasant scent, but today it just makes me nauseous. I glance at my phone. No signal. Which is odd, because we had signal at the summer party. Swallowing hard, I force my feet to move. Come on, I say, keeping my voice low, controlled. You want to see what I found, don't you? Betts doesn't reply, but I feel him watching me, weighing up whether this is worth his time. Then I hear the soft scuff of his shoes against the floor as he follows. I lead him toward a concealed stairwell at the end of the carpeted landing. I slow down, glancing back just enough to meet his gaze. You ready for this? Betts tilts his head, amused.
You tell me.
I step forward, then stop. There's movement up ahead, a flicker of shadow in the glass reflection, and then I see him. Trent. Chapter 34. Trent leans against the wall at the far end, right by the door to where the summer party was held. His stance is lazy and casual, too casual. But his eyes give him away. They're locked on us, calculating and ready. Betts stops walking. The muscle in his jaw pulses.
You told me he was away.
He turns on me so fast I flinch. His face twists with rage.
You set me up again, you bitch.
Set you up? My voice is low, seething. I'm the one trapped in your mess. Trent pushes off the wall and walks toward us. The air turns suddenly brittle, and for a few seconds, no one speaks. Let's take this upstairs, Trent says at last, his voice calm and reasonable. His eyes flick to the black domes of the security cameras overhead before he looks back at Betts. No monitoring up there. We can clear the air, once and for all. Betts hesitates. He's weighing it up. His eyes dart to me, then back to Trent. His fists flex, a slow nod. They move toward the stairwell, but I can't follow. My feet won't shift. The second they disappear, I force air into my lungs and move, keeping my steps light and silent against the carpeted steps. At the top, I press against the security door, peering through the glass. The Orbit has an incredible skyline bar, but this side of the rooftop is brutal. Steel and concrete cast in the stark glare of industrial floodlights. Thick cables snake across air conditioning units, and metal piping runs all around the perimeter. It's a place built for function, not for leisure or escape. Betts and Trent face each other in the open, bodies tense, reminding me of rival animals about to strike. I don't know what Trent has planned. My job was just to lure Betts here, and from that point of view, my job is done. But I'm not going anywhere yet. I push the bar of the security door and open it a touch so I can hear what's being said. I check my phone again. There's nothing. Quite unusual at the top of a building in central London. It's like I'm in a dead zone. Betsy's voice is sharp, venomous, pulling my attention back.
You've been playing me all along, haven't you? Using her to dig up dirt. I should have known.
He gives a harsh laugh.
What you don't know is I got to her first. She's been working for me for the last 2 years.
Trent doesn't even flinch. I've already told him this, but I know he'll still be reeling from the shock of it, of me demanding the truth about Saskia when I've been lying and betraying him all along.
I didn't need Alicia to find the dirt on you.
Trent's voice is calm, but there's an edge to it.
You've been dirty your whole life, Steve. Everybody knows it,
except Manchester City Council.
You're just pissed now because you finally run out of places to hide.
Betts's face darkens.
You're just as corrupt. The only difference is I don't pretend to be the good guy.
Trent shifts, and for the first time, I see it. The tightness in his shoulders, the way his hands curl into fists. He looks like he's starting to lose control. Trent exhales, slow and measured, but I see the way his fists twitch, like he's itching to swing. Betts sees it too.
You should have stayed out of my business,
Betts says, voice slick with satisfaction.
You've brought this on yourself because I will find a way to finish you.
Trent's eyes narrow.
Your business.
He lets out a short, humorless laugh.
That's a generous word for a money laundering operation with a possible side of human trafficking.
Next month's planning and regeneration committee is going to throw this out before you've even sat your ass down. Betts shrugs, unbothered.
You say that like you've got proof. But I know you, Trent. You wouldn't be standing here if you had anything solid. You'd be making deals behind my back, letting someone else take the fall.
His gaze sharpens.
So then let's hear it. What do you really have?
For a second, Trent doesn't answer. He holds Betts's stare, assessing. Then he shifts his weight slightly, tilting his chin up.
Okay, let's see. Your investors.
His voice is quiet but certain.
The ones funneling cash through your properties. I know exactly how much is dirty, who's behind it, and how much they stand to lose if you go down.
Betts's sneer flickers. But just for a second, a crack in his confidence, Trent presses on.
And I wonder what they'd do if they found out you've been skimming. You think those people are loyal? They'll drop you the second you become a liability. And right now, you're looking very expensive to keep around.
Betts' jaw tightens. He's got him. But then, just as quickly, Betts recovers. His smile is slow and deliberate. Something in my stomach clenches at the sight of it.
Nice try,
he murmurs.
But I'm still standing, and do you know why?
His voice lowers, turning lethal.
Because I've got something better. Something you can't make disappear, no matter how deep you bury it.
He leans in slightly.
Saskia Portman's death.
Trent goes still. He doesn't move a muscle, but I can almost feel the tension ripping through him. There's a shift in the air, heavy and suffocating. Betts watches, drinking it in like it's his favourite game.
I don't even have to say it, do I?
He continues.
We both know what happened that night. We both know how hard you worked to wipe it all clean. But here's the problem, mate.
He smirks.
Nothing stays buried forever. And thanks to our mutual friend, I've got a very interesting piece of footage in my possession.
He's bluffing. Talking as if I've handed him the CCTV footage. Who will Trent trust? Betts or me? Trent swallows, his hands flex, and for the first time I'm not sure who's holding the cards anymore. Then it happens. Trent lunges. A blur of movement. A grunt of impact. Betts staggers back, his arms flailing as he tries to grab onto something, anything. But there's nothing up here on the roof. They're both teetering at the edge. I hold my breath. Hold it while silently praying my ordeal is about to end. Betts staggers,
his body frozen in time for a fraction of a second. A second that stretches and stretches like the paused frame of a movie. And then, just as suddenly, he's gone. A choked scream rips through the night as he vanishes over the edge. I can't breathe. My skull is pounding. I lean on the security door and it swings wide open. Trent straightens, his chest rising and falling hard. He doesn't move, just stands there staring into the abyss below. Then he turns, and his eyes find mine. Cold, dark, calculating. She's been working for me for the last 2 years. A pulse of terror floods through my veins. I didn't give him the footage, I say hoarsely. I should run, but I can't move, I can't even blink. For a moment or two, Trent just watches me, and I swear he's considering whether to send me the same way as Betts. And then he bolts, across the rooftop and down the stairs over the other side. I suck in a breath, stumbling back from the open door, my legs shaking so hard they almost give way. I run down the stairs to the lift, punching at the button repeatedly. Betts is gone. He's finally gone. And the feeling rising inside me isn't just shock or horror at what I've just witnessed. It's relief that I'm free of him at last. But now, there's only one thing on my mind. I have to find Jen and Brody. Chapter 35. 1 hour earlier. Jen. Inside the building, Jen follows the woman, Amanda, down the dim hallway, her arms tightening around Brody as he stirs against her shoulder. She shouldn't be here. Nothing about this place matches what she was told by Alicia, but Amanda says she has a message for her. The air is redolent with the greasy tang of old cooking oil, the kind that clings to walls long after the food is gone. Beneath it, a stale damp, the slow rot of a place that's been neglected for years. Her breath feels shallow, like she can't bear to let the air inside herself. A battered bicycle leans against the peeling wall, its front wheel twisted at an unnatural angle. On a scratched wooden table, messy piles of unopened mail sprawl in every direction, some yellowed, some curling at the edges like they've been left to decay. How long since Alicia has been here? The floorboards creak beneath her feet, warped and uneven, lifting in places like some malevolent force is pushing up from underneath. Jen feels sick to her stomach. She trusted her sister. Alicia, who had a life, a nice life in London with a good job. That's what she said. That's what she made Jen believe. But this is something else entirely. This is definitely not good. Her grip on Brody tightens. The weight of him is grounding, but her pulse won't slow. She's attacked a man, she's on the run, and needs Alicia's help. But now, she's walked headlong into something that doesn't make any sense. The dreary hallway seems to stretch, growing darker the further they go, the walls pressing in. Amanda props her bike against the wall and gestures to a door. This is me, ground floor. Jen shushes Brody in her arms, hoping he'll settle. Where did Alicia stay?
Third floor. She wasn't here long at all.
A flicker of unease tugs at Jen's gut. You said you had a message. Is it from my sister? Amanda reaches into her pocket and pulls out an envelope. She hands it over, and Jen's heart stutters when she sees her name written across it. But the handwriting looks wrong. It's not Alicia's. Brody wakes fully with a soft whimper, his tiny body shifting in her arms. Amanda leans forward. Want me to take him a moment while you read it? Jen hesitates, then nods, letting Amanda lift him from her arms. She bounces him gently on her hip as Jen swallows and tears open the envelope. Hello, Jen. You don't know me, but my name is Eleanor Summers, and I'm a good friend of your sister. Alicia went to your house in Nottingham and found you and Brody were missing. She's so worried, and I'm helping her find you as she has no way of contacting you. If you're reading this,
You'll know Alicia doesn't live in the bedsit any longer. Please call me immediately when you get this note. I will come and get you and Brody and reunite you with your sister. Then she can explain everything. Eleanor has signed her name at the bottom and provided a mobile phone number. Jen's fingers tighten around the note. What the hell is going on? She looks over at Amanda. How did you get this note? When I got home yesterday, a woman was here. She said someone who used to live here needed to get a message to her sister. Jen takes Brody back from her. She asked me if I knew Alicia Turner, and I said I did. Then she gave me the note and 20 quid, and said there'd be another 50 for me if I managed to get this note to you if you turned up here. Jen stares at her, trying to make sense of it all and failing. I'd call her, but I don't have my phone. Here. Amanda is already fishing hers out of her pocket, no doubt thinking about her £50 bonus. Use mine. Jen dials Eleanor's number, her fingers trembling. A woman answers almost immediately, and Jen clears her throat. Hi, my name's Jen Turner, and I'm at my sister's bedsit in...
Jen! Oh, thank God.
A woman gasps, her voice full of relief. Stay exactly where you are. I'm on my way. 20 minutes later, a silver Mercedes pulls up outside the house. From the hallway, Jen sees two women inside. She and Amanda walk outside. The female driver with short black hair stays put, but the other, a tall woman with pinned-up blonde hair, steps out, passing Amanda some cash before turning to Jen.
You're Jen, she says. It's not a question.
I'm Eleanor, and the driver is my wife, Hazel. Jen nods cautiously. Eleanor's voice softens.
You and Brody are safe now. We're taking you to see your sister.
Jen glances at Amanda, who offers a small, encouraging nod. With one last grateful thank you, she carries Brody to the car. Inside, the seats are buttery leather, the expensive smell filling the air, and Jen thinks the vehicle must be brand new. As the car pulls away, she can't wait for answers.
Who are you?
She asks.
Where has Alicia been living? And with respect, why has she never mentioned you?
Eleanor meets her gaze in the rearview mirror. She'll explain everything herself soon. I've been trying to call her to let her know you two are safe, but her phone seems to be turned off. But we're almost there now, so it won't be long.
Where?
You'll see. When the car finally slows, Jen's breath catches. Towering above them, is an enormous steel and glass building, sleek and imposing, its windows reflecting the sky with its fading light as the sun drops lower and clouds gather. Eleanor steps out and opens Jen's door. This is the Orbit. It's where Alicia lives now. Jen stares up at it, incredulous.
You're kidding me.
Someone is playing a cruel joke here. They have to be. Eleanor doesn't respond, just gently urges her inside. A uniformed doorman, a thick-set man with crinkly eyes and a big smile bearing a polished name tag reading Barry, greets them with a polite nod. They step into a mirrored elevator, which glides smoothly up, higher and higher, until Jen thinks her ears might pop. When the doors open on the 50th floor, Eleanor gestures ahead.
We'll wait in our apartment until Alicia gets here. It shouldn't be long now.
Chapter 36. Alicia. I watch in horror as the blood from the body spreads in slow, thick ribbons across the pavement, dark and glistening. Channeling into the grooves between the pavement stones, it pools near my shoe, but I don't step back. My phone is vibrating in my pocket, now it has signal again. I take it out and see so many notifications.
Jen.
Brody. I tap at the screen as in the distance, sirens wail, growing louder, drawing closer. People clamour to the edges of the scene, backs pressing against shop fronts, eyes flicking between the body and the building. Behind me, the crowd is swelling,
pressing forward, drawn by the spectacle. People jostle, their faces lit with horror, with fascination. A man gasps. A woman cries out. London hums all around us, restless and alive. The pavement is spotting with rain, and there is stalled traffic all along the street. Brake lights jam on and off while horns blare, urgent and angry. All of it swallowed by the rising tide of panicked voices. Text messages from Eleanor. We have news. They're safe. Come now. I tilt my head back, my eyes scaling the sublime jagged spine of glass and steel that pierces the night sky. The building is a shimmering blaze of light where figures move behind the glass, shadowed and frantic. They're safe. I hear Eleanor's voice calling out my name. I see a uniformed line pressing closer, but I don't move. I can't. I'm in a trance, still staring down at the wide, staring eyes, the mangled body. A mash of blood, flesh and bone I can't bear to look at. Then Eleanor moves to my side, whispering in my ear. I barely register her hand gripping my arm, pulling me away from Betts's lifeless body. My legs feel unsteady, the cold night air slicing through my clothes. But I move. I let her guide me back inside, past the hushed murmurs of onlookers, past the glances I don't dare meet. Barry, the doorman, is waiting in the foyer, a thick blanket draped over his arm, a steaming cup of tea in his other hand. He presses both into my grasp without a word. I need to see Jen and Brody. They're safe, Alicia. Just drink the tea and I'll take you to them, Eleanor says softly. The blanket is rough but warm, the tea scalding against my fingertips. I wrap my hands around the cup and lower myself onto the worn leather chair in Barry's office, forcing a slow breath. Eleanor watches me closely, arms folded, concern shadowing her features. You're handling this remarkably well, she says, her voice careful. Most people would be shaking in shock. I nod and take a sip of tea to buy a second, letting the heat burn down my throat, grounding me. I need to see my son. I feel all woozy, like I've been drinking. I don't tell her the truth, that I watched Betts fall, that I saw Trent push him, that my heartbeat is steady, not because I'm unaffected, but because I don't have the luxury of breaking down. Not yet. Instead, I meet Eleanor's gaze, my expression smooth and practiced. I'll be fine, I say, once I find my son. She insists I go with her to her apartment so she can make sure I'm okay, she says. It's the last thing I want to do, but Eleanor's turning out to be a good friend, so grudgingly, I agree. The elevator ride to the 50th floor is silent, except for the soft hum of the machinery. Eleanor stands close, arms folded, watching me as if I might crumple at any moment. I won't. I can't. Hazel is waiting for us at the door. I catch something, a look, passing between them. Then I hear it, a soft, high-pitched giggle. My breath catches. I know that joyous laugh. A small shape moves in the corner of my vision, small and unsteady. I turn sharply, my heart seeming to slam into my ribs, and then I see him. A raw, aching sound I don't recognize as my own emerges from inside me. My chest tightens, my throat clogs, and for a moment, I can't move. I can't breathe. I just stare. Brody's little arms stretch toward me, his chubby fingers curling and uncurling, his face alight with recognition. My legs give out before I can reach him, and suddenly, I'm on my knees, arms wide, gathering him to me as he stumbles into my embrace. His small body presses against mine, solid and real. I bury my face in his soft curls, inhaling his scent, baby shampoo, warm skin, and I try and fail to mask a sob of gratitude. My baby! My voice cracks, my fingers gripping the back of his tiny shirt like I can keep him here forever. Then Jen walks into the room, silent and shaking as she watches us. I look up at her, my vision blurred, and then suddenly she's kneeling beside me, wrapping her arms around us both. I was starting to believe I might never see you both again, I whisper. Jen shakes her head fiercely. I promised you I'd look after him, and I did. I clutch my sister, clutch Brody, my whole world right there in my arms. I pull back just enough to look at Brody's face, his big, trusting eyes, his little pouty lips, his flushed cheeks. I love you so much, sweetheart, I whisper, kissing his forehead, his nose, his cheeks. Mummy loves you so, so much, and I'm never leaving you again. He giggles, pure, sweet, unknowing joy. And it breaks something inside me. Because after everything, after the terror, the loss, the gut-wrenching emptiness, he's still here. He's all mine. And I will never, ever let him go again. We're going out for a while. Leave you two to talk. I look up to see Eleanor and Hazel in the doorway. I'm guessing you've got a lot of catching up to do. Jen glances at Eleanor and nods before looking back at me. I think you're right, she says. Chapter 37. Jen. Alicia and Jen lock eyes, an unspoken sisterly bond made out of scars and shared nightmares tightens between them, strengthened by survival. Time for us to be honest with each other, Alicia says. Her voice is steady, but the weight behind her words feels crushing to Jen. Who's first? Jen lets out a slow breath and lifts a hand like a child in class. Me. I can't wait to get this monkey off my back. She hesitates. Eleanor told me you'd been to the house and that's how you knew we'd disappeared. Alicia nods. That's how I knew for sure you'd taken Scodden back too. His clothes, his mail. It was all there. Shame burns through Jen's chest. She drops her head, nodding, a bitter taste in her mouth. I couldn't tell you, Alicia. I just couldn't. She forces herself to look up. After everything I saw happen in between Mum and Dad, how she could never break free of him. And I did the exact same thing, not once, but twice. I walked straight into the fire, again. I was so angry, Alicia says, her fingers curling into fists before she releases them. I couldn't believe you'd put Brody in danger like that. But when I pieced it all together, your ultimatum of only keeping him a month, your stress, and the way you looked, I blamed myself. I'm so sorry. I knew, almost immediately, I'd made a terrible mistake, but I didn't know how to fix it. So how did it end? Alicia asks, her voice quieter now. Jen swallows, then forces herself to speak. Pete found the money he gave me, told me we were leaving. I saw it in his eyes. He was on the edge of losing control, the same way he had before. Her throat tightens. When he broke down the bathroom door and dragged us back downstairs, I knew it was now or never. So when he came at me, like a wild animal, I swung the metal giraffe straight into his head. Alicia's eyes widen. A slow, wicked smile creeps across her face. You did that. To him? Jen nods, barely breathing. Alicia blows out air. I'm so bloody proud of you. I saw blood on the giraffe, but I didn't know whose it was.
Jen shakes her head. It didn't stop him. He was dazed, but still coming. I grabbed Broder, ran, flagged down a cab and got to the train station. Broder slept in the waiting room until the next train, but I couldn't sleep a wink. She clenches her jaw.
He'll find me again. Men like him always do.
Alicia leans forward, gripping her hand.
Not this time, Jen.
Jen frowns.
What do you mean?
Alicia holds her gaze.
Scothen is dead.
He stepped in front of a car. Died on the roadside. A couple of streets away from your house, I saw him with my own eyes.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
Jen's breath catches. Her hand flies to her mouth.
That means I must have killed him.
Alicia grips her shoulders.
Never, ever say those words again.
Her voice is firm. You didn't kill him. You saved yourself. You saved Brody from a monster. That's all you need to tell yourself. Jen's face crumples, and Alicia doesn't hesitate. She pulls her into a fierce hug, wrapping her arms around her sister and holding on tight. Jen's shoulders shake, sobs building, breaking loose in ragged gasps against her sister's shoulder. Alicia smooths Jen's hair with one hand, whispering soft reassurances, even though her own heart must be hammering with all that leftover fear.
It's over,
Alicia murmurs, squeezing her tighter.
You did what you had to do.
It's over now. Jen pulls back just enough to look at her, eyes red and swollen, and Alicia forces a smile, brushing a stray tear from her sister's cheek. Jen lets out a shaky laugh and leans back into the hug, both of them sweating a little, holding on like they might break apart if they let go. Chapter 38. Alicia. Jen busies herself with Brody, showing him how to bang a wooden spoon on upturned pans, the sound loud and joyful in Eleanor's small living room. I watch the two of them, my chest tight. It kills me that Jen feels an ounce of guilt over that piece of filth Pete Scothen. But that's just the kind of person Jen is. Me? Not so much. Which is why I can live with what I did to Steve Betts. He stole 2 years of my life. He threatened my sister and my child. And in the end, I led him straight into the trap that would finish him off. Your turn, Jen says softly, snapping me from my thoughts. I force a breath, steel myself. Let's start with why I left Nottingham. Jen nods. That's a good place to start. I've wondered about it every day since you've been gone. I exhale. There's something you need to know first. My business, the one you always called mysterious, made you good money, but I never really got to the bottom of what you actually did. I lean forward. I was a private investigator for infidelity cases. Jen narrows her eyes. Like catching cheating husbands? More like setting them up. A slow smile tugs at the corners of her mouth. Ever heard of the term honey trap? Jen's eyes widen. Alicia nods. That's how I met Steve Betts. I tell her how Betts' wife approached me after he'd had multiple affairs. He'd gaslight her, telling her it was all in her imagination, and he told her she'd never get her hands on his money if she went for a divorce. He sounds a total monster, Jen says with a frown.
You have no idea,
I say. Anyway, his wife wanted out of the marriage to start her life again with her kids, and so she needed the evidence for court. We decided, when he attended an overnight conference in Newcastle, that would be the perfect opportunity for me to do my thing. I go into detail for Jen, dredging up that night just over 2 years ago when I arrived at the dimly lit cocktail lounge at the Malmaison at Newcastle Quayside. I'd ordered a cocktail while I waited,
15 minutes stretched out like an hour before Betts finally arrived. He sauntered in, alone. I could see him at the bar, looking around like he owned the place. I took a seat at the bar, facing away from him. His voice carried enough for me to hear him ordering a whiskey. I watched him from the corner of my eye. His phone was practically glued to his hand. 10 minutes later, he was already on his second whiskey and still scrolling. He looked up idly at first. Then I saw him double take. I could almost hear the gears turning in his head. Woman, alone. When my cocktail arrived in a fancy glass with a cherry on the rim, the barman grinned and said the gentleman at the bar had just paid for my drink. Sounds a real charmer, Jen remarks. Oh, yes. He sauntered over and said, I can't see a beautiful girl paying for her own drinks. Can you believe it? Anyway, he invited himself to sit on the bar stool next to mine and then began to non-stop talk about himself and how amazing he was. No way. Yep. He covered his business ventures, his connections, his expensive tastes in the first 20 minutes. I nodded in all the right places, asked a question here and there to keep him fully engaged. When he invited me to dinner, I played it coy at first. I'm not sure, I said, checking my watch. I said I'd love to, but that I had to prepare for a meeting the next morning. Bet he didn't like that, Jen says. He became even keener, and I knew he saw me as a challenge. Dine with me and you won't forget it, he said. I'm talking Michelin star, probably the best night you've had in your life. Jen laughs. This guy, you must have wanted to burst out laughing. His arrogance was off the scale. But I knew that anyway from talking to his poor wife. After dinner, he leaned closer over coffee and told me categorically that he wasn't married. He said, it's just me, no ties. Jen raises her eyebrows. Ugh, what a toe rag. I nod. I played the part of the attentive listener while the tiny covert camera nestling in my buttonhole did its work. Jen grins. Brilliant. Love it. He said we could stay at the hotel together that night.
No one will know, just you and me. How about it, Alicia? We'd have so much fun.
And my little camera captured it all. Every word. Every slimy move. Steve Betts was busted. His wife filed for divorce and forced him to leave the family home. He had a drug habit and a drink problem, and she got a court order to stop him seeing the kids. Serves the dirty rat right, Jen scowls. But how does this fit in with why you left Nottingham? I'm getting to that. But it's important for you to understand what kind of a man he was. And that he was guilty as hell, I explain. Within a month, my life became a living nightmare. My flat was broken into, my possessions not stolen, but rooms trashed. Bitch daubed in red paint on my front door and my car. I narrowly missed being killed in the street when a car jumped a red light, and just as I managed to leap back at the last moment, the driver screamed, "That's for Steve Betts," from the open window. Jen's expression is one of pure shock. And you never told me any of this. Someone was looking for revenge. I didn't want you dragged into it. So I moved out of the flat and rented another one on the other side of town. Within days, I got a note shoved through the letterbox. "We know where you are. There's nowhere to run, bitch." This continued for months, and then Betts contacted me with a proposal. If I agreed to work as an unpaid investigator for him, sniffing out the dirt on his business associates, he'd guarantee mine and Brody's safety. I jumped at the chance to get out of the hellish situation he'd put me in. I did several jobs for him for no pay, but it meant I hadn't got the time to do my own work. "That's why you lost your flat and look so anxious all the time," I nod. Then Betts told me he had a really big job for me in London, and this time he'd pay me expenses. I couldn't turn it down, but I couldn't take Brody with me.
Meanwhile, I watched you, Jen, in the midst of a living nightmare at the hands of that piece of shit, Pete Scothern. I didn't tell you why I was running, but I knew you needed to run with me. And so we hatched that plan together. I'm following you so far, Jen says. When I got to London, Trent Connors, the owner of this building, I sweep my arm around Eleanor's apartment, offered me a way out without knowing he was my mark. Ironically, Trent wanted me to dig the dirt on Betts, but he offered to pay me an absolute fortune to do it. So that's where all your money came from? Yes. I couldn't turn it down. And obviously, I couldn't tell Trent I was supposed to be in cahoots with Betts. I tried to play them both, and, well, it went horribly wrong, as you might expect. I had no choice but to work for Trent because I knew I'd never escape Betts. I planned to get enough money for us all to start a new life abroad. And now, what? Now everything has changed. Because Betts is dead, I say, a wonderful warmth washing over me. Chapter 39. The Metro, London, May 2025. Businessman dies in tragic rooftop incident. Stephen Betts, 48, a prominent London businessman, tragically passed away on Sunday evening following an incident on the rooftop terrace of The Orbit, the capital's newest luxury metropolitan enclave. Emergency services were called to the scene shortly after 9 p.m., but were unable to save Mr. Betts, who was pronounced dead at the scene. Police have confirmed they are not seeking anyone else in connection with the incident, which they are treating as non-suspicious. A spokesperson added, "We ask for privacy on behalf of Mr. Betts' family during this difficult time. We will not be making any further comment." Speculation runs wild. Reader comments. At Simon Says 89. Jumper. I heard the guy had big money problems. At Sadie on X25. Have some respect. You don't know that for sure. At Darts Dame 180. Something funny going on at that place. A woman drowned in the pool there 2 or 3 years ago. At Simon Says 89. Yeah, that was an accident too, apparently. Chapter 40. 1 week later. Trent. The knock at the door is sharp and precise, slicing through the stillness of the penthouse and the 5 minutes peace he's carved out for himself. He'll miss this place. Trent doesn't look up immediately, his eyes remaining on the Manchester Council documents in front of him, scribbling a footnote on one. From his position in the lounge, he hears Ingrid get the door, her stilted greeting, followed by voices, low and authoritative. His pen stills. Ingrid appears moments later, her expression composed as ever, though he detects the faintest edge of discomfort in her manner. "There are 2 detectives here to see you, Mr. Connors," she says. The announcement sends a sharp jolt through him, but Trent does not flinch. Instead, he leans back in his chair, setting the pen down.
"Detectives," he repeats faintly. "By all means, show them through."
Ingrid nods and retreats, and he allows himself a moment to steady his breathing. It isn't fear. Fear is beneath him, but certainly a prickle of irritation and concern. Police intrusions of any description are messy and nearly always disruptive. The week after next, his contact at the council has confirmed the Planning and Regeneration Committee will authorise the Orbit Manchester project, and it's vital he keeps his focus on that. Trent smooths his shirt cuffs, adjusts the angle of his chair, and waits. Hopefully, this won't take long. The detectives enter a moment later, their footsteps muffled by the thick carpeting.
The man is stout and heavy-set, with a flushed face, while the woman is sharp-eyed, tall and thin, her short hair tucked neatly behind her ears. Trent doesn't bother to rise, but gestures with a vague sweep of his hand for them to sit.
"Thank you, Ingrid,"
he says, as she discreetly retreats back down the corridor. As expected, the detectives falter slightly, their steps slowing as their gazes are drawn to the sprawling vista of London, 65 floors below them. The effect is always the same. People can't help but gape at the skyline, and the city stretching endlessly in every direction. It's a view few ever get to see and enjoy, and as he likes to remind himself, fewer still can claim it as their own.
"Detectives,"
Trent says smoothly, folding his hands in his lap.
"What can I do for you?"
The woman resists the magnetism of the view first, her gaze snapping back to him. "Detective Sergeant Kelly Harper. And of course you've met Detective Inspector AJ Kumar," she says. Trent swallows, repeats the name silently to himself. AJ Kumar. And then it clicks. Shit, shit, shit.
"Mr. Connors,"
Kumar says with a smile.
"It's nice to see you again. We're here about some new information that's come to light regarding the death of Saskia Portman. As you might recall, I ran the original investigation."
His comment lands like a gut punch, but Trent doesn't let that show. They can't know about the CCTV footage. He's given Alicia everything she asked for, and she's returned the memory stick, so there's no risk from that quarter. And Ingrid's loyalty is watertight. He leans back slightly, his expression one of polite interest. Harper continues. "We're revisiting the circumstances of her death. Could you tell us again about the night Miss Portman died?" Trent exhales, his eyes flicking briefly to the window.
"You're aware I've been through this many, many times already."
He allows just a hint of weariness to edge his voice.
"We'd had a night out, and Saskia had had far too much to drink. I came back to the penthouse, and she went up for a swim. Sadly, it seems she slipped, fell into the water, and drowned."
He ignores Harper and looks at Kumar as the senior detective.
"Can I ask what all this is about?"
"You came back to the penthouse that night," Harper continues, her voice low, almost monotone, but Trent can hear the weight of authority in it.
"Are you sure about that?"
Trent blinks, prickles of discomfort creeping up his spine.
"I'm very sure."
He pauses before adding,
"What's this new information you mentioned?"
"We'll get to that in a moment." Kumar's expression remains impassive. "We'd like you to come down to the station for further questioning." Trent freezes, the room seeming to contract around him. That doesn't really sound like a request. It's rare he feels hemmed in and cornered, although he knows better than to let it show.
"Fine. I have nothing to hide,"
he says, his voice as smooth as ever.
"But in return, I think I have a right to know what the new information is you mentioned."
Harper steps back, pulls out her phone, and presses the screen, angling it toward Trent. He feels the color drain out of his face in an instant.
"That bitch,"
he mutters, past caring that the detectives are there to hear him.
"Alicia Turner, she's given you this, right?"
"I'm sorry," Harper frowns.
"What's she been telling you?"
"We've had no contact from anyone of that name," she says carefully. "Our information has come from someone else, a very reliable source." He catches sight of Ingrid hovering in the hallway, her face pale, her eyes wide. For a second or two, the words hang in the air like a thunderclap. For the first time, Trent feels his mask shift, his mouth opening slightly before he clamps it shut.
"This footage must be fake,"
he says, his voice sharp.
"I can assure you, I've done nothing wrong."
Trent feels the floor beneath him tilt, the certainty he's always carried, his untouchable status, his carefully constructed fortress here in the sky. It's all cracking at the edges.
He's led out of the foyer of the Orbit, in full view of a growing crowd of onlookers. A cluster of press jostle for the best spot, shouting out questions and snapping cameras.
Have you been charged with the murder of Saskia Portman, Trent? Did you kill her?
He keeps his gaze on the ground in front of him as he considers the irony that only 2 years before, he'd walked in through this very same entrance, patted on the back by these same journalists, told he was a genius for creating this tremendous, iconic building. Something makes him look up, and he locks eyes briefly with a woman who looks vaguely familiar. She's standing back from the noisy crowd, watching quietly, with a detached integrity that somehow cuts to the core of him, but he can't quite place her. The back door of the police car opens, and an officer presses a hand to the top of his head as he clambers in. He steals a final glance at the woman, and now sees she's holding up an A3-sized poster featuring a photograph. Printed across the top, in bold red letters, are the words, "Justice for Saskia." Chapter 41. A few days earlier. New reply to thread. I miss her every single day. Hello, Saskia's mum. You don't know me, but I've recently learned about your daughter's tragic death, and I want to start by saying how deeply sorry I am for your loss. Saskia sounds like such a wonderful, kind person, and I can feel the love you have for her in every word you've written here on this thread. This is going to sound unusual, but I have some important information about Saskia's death. I can't go into detail here, but I believe it could help answer some of the questions that must be keeping you up at night. I understand you might worry I'm not genuine, but I promise you that's not the case. I'm a mother too, and I can only imagine the pain you're feeling. I don't want to cause you any more distress, but I also feel it's important you have the full facts. If you're willing, we can meet in a public place, somewhere you feel safe. I have something for you that will help to answer all your questions about what happened to your daughter that night. I won't be able to offer any further involvement myself, but I truly believe this could help to bring you closure. I'm leaving my email address below. Please feel free to contact me directly if you're open to meeting up. I'm looking forward to hearing from you, and I hope this message brings you even the smallest step closer to finding some peace. Take care. The author's name has been withheld. Chapter 42. Alicia. The message from Saskia's mum sits on my phone like an unexploded bomb. I stare at it long after I've read it, wondering if this is the moment where everything changes, again. I've spent the morning thinking about what I might say to her if she replies, how I might begin to tell her what I have in my possession. Apologies seem too small for what she's lost, and promises feel so insincere, even though I mean to deliver everything I've offered, if she accepts. What I've done, and what I'm about to do, none of it will bring Saskia back. The last thing I want to do is crush this woman even further. But who knows? Maybe it will galvanize her to action and, in turn, stop someone else from sharing Saskia's terrible fate. Maybe it will be enough. Barry the doorman pulls open the heavy glass door and tips his hat.
Morning, Miss Turner.
I force a smile and shake my head. Told you before, Barry. It's just Alicia. I tease, my voice light. The thought of him addressing me like that feels ridiculous, like wearing someone else's clothes. I'm a wealthy woman now, yes, but the money came at a cost I can't ignore. Trent's leaving the penthouse at the end of this week, just as I asked, but he's just moving to another floor for now, until he gets sorted somewhere else. As an extra sweetener, I managed to get him to issue me with a rent-free 2-year lease on the penthouse as part of my directorship of his company, provided I keep my promise not to go to the police. The street outside hums with life. Red buses rumble past, their tires splashing through the early morning rain. A black cab crawls up behind a delivery van, its horn blaring as a cyclist negotiates the traffic. Pedestrians flood the pavement, heads down, clutching their takeout coffees and phones, moving with a singular purpose. The air is sharp with exhaust fumes, cut by the occasional waft of warm pastry from a nearby bakery. I walk the short distance to the small cafe, clutching my bag with its precious contents tightly. The cafe door jingles as I push it open, and I inhale as the familiar warmth and scent of good coffee wrap around me like a comfort blanket. The cafe is busy, but not packed. Conversations hum at scattered tables, the hiss of the espresso machine punctuating the air. I scan the room, searching for Mrs. Portman, someone who might look like Saskia. But my gaze hitches on someone entirely unexpected. The realization comes an instant later, and it feels like an electric shock. A strange, crawling sensation ripples across my skin before my mind catches up. The woman at the corner table is already watching me. She stands slowly, her movements deliberate. Her face is familiar in a way that sends a shiver right through me. The hell is she doing here? Hello, Alicia. You're here to see me, she says, her voice calm, but with an edge that makes me shiver. I blink, my throat suddenly dry. Janice? Yes. I'm Saskia Portman's mother. Her sharp eyes, the same ones that watched me every time there was an event at the Orbit, that I can now see look so much like Saskia's. They're pinned on me now. My brain is feverishly trying to make sense of what's happening here, but Janice gestures to the table behind her. Let's sit down, she says simply, as though it's not strange that she's here waiting for me when I thought I was meeting someone else, a stranger. I pull out a chair and sit down, my legs feeling a bit unsteady. Why did you ask me to meet you, Alicia? She asks. I open my mouth to answer, but then hesitate. The truth feels too raw to just come out with it straight. I came across your posts on the bereavement thread, I say, frowning. And I've got something for you that I hope will help you. But wait. You lost Saskia, your daughter. And yet you work at the Orbit. Where it happened. Janice nods. You have to understand. When the investigation into my daughter's death ground to a halt, I felt desperate. I had to do something, anything, to stop myself from going under. I've worked in hospitality all my life, and that experience got me in at Elevate because I knew they did some of the Orbit events. It was the same reason I'd started working for Elevate, to get close to Trent Connors, to appease Steve Betts. Little had I known, Trent would offer me the job of my dreams, and the chance to get away from Betts, plunging me into a battle between the two of them. I think about Janice watching me resentfully from the other side of the room whenever I was with Trent in my fancy clothes and jewelry. Now I know she'd have been constantly thinking about her daughter. I felt like you hated me, I say quietly. Hated you? No, but I could see you falling for Connors in the same way Saskia did. I watched him watching you almost from the moment you arrived, but I couldn't warn you. So when you spilled the drinks, I saw my chance to get you away from him. Now the way she'd instantly fired me makes more sense. You were trying to save me because of Saskia. You reminded me a bit of her. Your manner, your looks, she says, her voice soft but steady. Saskia was bright and beautiful. Optimistic too. The kind of person who always expected the best from life.
She wasn't naive, just hopeful.
She smiles faintly.
She was everything I wasn't, really.
I nod, but say nothing, letting her speak at her own pace. Janice looks down at her hands.
When she got an offer to work in London as a hospitality hostess for big corporate events, she was over the moon. She couldn't pack fast enough. I told her to keep her wits about her, warned her that London wasn't like home. But Saskia, she was too excited to listen.
Her damp gaze flicks up to meet mine.
That's where she met him. Trent Connors.
She says his name like it's a curse, her lip curling slightly.
She fell for him fast, too fast. She told me he was charming and successful. Older, but not too old. Sophisticated.
Her voice sharpens.
I didn't like the sound of him. I told her to keep her independence at least until she knew him better. But she was head over heels. Moved in with him after just a few days.
She pauses, sipping her tea. I notice her hands trembling slightly as she sets the mug down.
At first, she seemed happy. She called me every day, gushing about him, how generous he was, how much he adored her. Then I started noticing little things.
Janice's eyes grow distant.
She stopped going out with her friends. He didn't like her posting pictures online, said it was tacky and unprofessional.
Controlling, I say quietly, thinking about the information and photos I'd found in his folder.
I thought so too. But every time I brought it up, she'd brush it off, say I was being paranoid.
Janice stares down into her mug.
Trent Connors was all she wanted to talk about when she called home. The police questioned him about what happened, you know. But he managed to wriggle out of any suggestion of wrongdoing. Led them to believe Saskia was off her head regularly on drugs and drink. Call it a mother's intuition, but I've always been certain he had something to do with Saskia's death. I've just never been able to prove it.
I regard her sadly. The pinched mouth, the deep creases around her eyes and forehead, the product of 1,000 nights without sleep. Mourning for her beloved daughter.
I watched you at all the events, right from that very first night when you joined the team as a waitress.
Janice says, her voice dropping lower.
I saw you with Trent, and I wanted so badly to warn you, but I felt sure, just like Saskia, you wouldn't listen.
I nod. I probably wouldn't have done a few weeks ago. But now, well, now I know he has a different side to him. I sigh and lace my fingers together on the tabletop. This is so difficult for me, Janice. Because what I have to tell you, to show you, it could finally crush you. She shakes her head.
I can't get any lower. When I got your message, I was on the edge of giving up on everything.
She says. Her voice unflinching.
But I want Connors to pay if he's involved in my daughter's death. Justice for Saskia is what keeps me going.
There's a tiny light there, behind her mask of grief, and it reassures me she is ready for what I'm about to do. My heart pounds in my chest, but before I can change my mind, I reach into my bag and pull out a sealed envelope. I slide it to her across the table. Inside, you'll find a memory stick, I tell her. It will break your heart, but it will also tell you everything you need to know about how your daughter died. Her face pales.
The CCTV was working that night.
Yes. He did a good clean-up job, but not quite good enough. I can't get involved any further, but it's your decision what you do with this. It's the last copy that exists. Epilogue. The wind tugs at my hair as I stand high above London, clutching my son's small, warm hand. The city sprawls before us, like a glittering, restless thing.
Look!
Brody exclaims, pointing to the river below. I smile at the way he still has a capacity for wonder. I inhale, filling my lungs. The weight I've carried for years feels so much lighter. There was a time when I didn't think I'd make it, when every step forward felt like trudging through quicksand. Times when I thought I'd lose myself completely. But now, here I am, standing tall again. And for the first time in forever, I'm not looking over my shoulder. I've made mistakes, too many to count. But they led me here, to this moment, to freedom. I pick up my son, and Brody wraps his arms around my neck and turns his face into me, away from the wind. I hold him tightly.
Are we safe now, Mummy?
He whispers. Yes. I close my eyes. Yes, Brody, we are. This is all that matters. Being together has always been the only thing that matters. You have been listening to The Waitress, an Audible original. Written by K.L. Slater. Narrated by Claudia Jesse. Directed by Lizzie Davies. The production was engineered by Adam Deveni at Forever Audio. Dialogue edit by 2020 Recordings. For Audible, the executive producer was Laura Marlowe. The production executive was Yuki Palmer. And the commissioning editor was Oliver Grant.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this